Support for the Commodity Week podcast comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign with crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Learn more at sfarmmarketing.com. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is the May 11 edition of Commodity Week.
Support for Commodity Week comes from Agrigold Hybrids, featuring the Agrigold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at agrigoldgiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Thursday morning, the United States Department of Agriculture released a bearish 166 bushel to the acre national average yield for corn. But it was Friday when the market tanked, and that was in soybeans. We'll try to find out today why in Commodity Week. Welcome to Commodity Week. I'm Todd Gleason. Later in this half hour, we'll talk with Jerry Bangy. He's at the World Agricultural Outlook Board in Washington, D.C., that put together Thursday morning's WASDE numbers. Our panelists in studio today include Brian Stark of the Andersons and Jackie Vakes of Stuart Peterson. Both are from Champaign, Illinois. On the phone line is Dan Zwicker. He's with CGB Enterprises Incorporated out of Mandeville, Louisiana. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media from the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. You can always find us online at willag.org. That's willag.org. Well, let's start our discussion with this question, Jackie Vakes. Why is it that the bean market dropped so sharply on Friday?
Well, first of all, we saw just a tremendous amount of fund selling, about 23,000 contracts, and then that led to technical selling. And it was easier to go down than it was to go up.
And Brian Stark?
I would agree with what Jackie said. I think it's mainly fund-driven. Some of it you can attribute to the maybe funds being a little spooked by J.P. Morgan's announcement of a bad trade costing them $2 billion. But we have to remember, usually the corn pit has a bigger fund length. And the last couple of months, beans have had a story. So they've had a larger length than soybeans and more prone to liquidation on any driven factor to cause them to sell.
And Dan Zwicker, if I could have you take up the USDA report release on Thursday morning instead, please, and what your reaction was when you saw the numbers.
Well, I think the what the trade focused on right away was the increase in old crop carryover supplies up to this 850 level. For the most part, the trade was kind of looking for maybe a 50 million bushel drop based upon the numbers, what they saw out of the March 1st stocks number. And instead, they got a 50 million bushel increase, and that just kind of pulled the plug out from underneath the tight supply scenario that the corn market had been working. So I think that was the shocker. As far as new crop goes, there was a lot of people talking about 166 bushel yield, just looking at the historical tendency of what the World Board has done. When you had good planting conditions and whatnot. So the big crop, I don't think, was that much of a surprise. But I think when you pull the plug out from underneath old crop with a larger ending stocks level, that's what really tanked the corn market.
Well, and I agree with you, Dan. I think also when you look at the world carryout numbers, when you see us jumping from 127 to 152 million metric tons, you know, 25 million more metric tons. And one of the things that shocked me was the fact that they raised the Brazilian corn crop from 62 million metric tons to 67 million metric tons. That was 5 million metric tons right there. You know, it's hard for any trade to digest those kinds of dramatic moves.
In the corn pit, as we ended the week, remember we give you the open outcry. The overnight electronic trade as well, all combined as one. Friday to Friday closes. The May corn had a high this week of $6.85¾. Its low was $6 even. May settled at $6.08, down 54¼ cents. December futures at $5.05¼ finished 19 cents lower. Brian, as you watch the expiration of the May coming, and it happens on Monday, and the July contracts, and then put that in place with what you're paying in basis and overs there at the Andersons and in Central Illinois. How do you see it playing out in the next 3 days?
Well, I think the May obviously is going to remain volatile on the last day of trading, but the key is we traded through some technical support on the July at 591, and obviously I think made a low of 577 today. It's really key for the July to show some life when the May starts trading for any type of old crop strength to come about. Basis levels have been very hot. I've been hearing close to 70 over the July has traded around Decatur. Old corn is hard to come by, so the cash markets argue for a tighter situation than what we saw from the government on Thursday in the old crop ending carryout number.
Do you want to follow up on that comment, please?
Well, I think the biggest thing, and one of the things I'll ask Jerry in a little bit, is the fact that Dan hit this March 1. The average estimated quarterly stocks number for corn was 150 million bushels above what the USDA had stated on March 30th. And then on the April S&D, figuring that would argue for maybe an increased feed usage number, they left that unchanged, and the carryout stayed at 801. And then we get to Thursday's report, and we actually go the other way, another 50 million in a decrease in feed usage. So it's very confusing to the trade whenever since we've been watching basis since November after harvest. It's been very firm, arguing for a very tighter scenario than what the government's painting.
But in that scenario, did they not tell us that there would be more feed wheat coming in, and that part of that would be offset if you think about old and new crop corn as different crops, so new crop corn offsetting the old crop
sure.
usage?
Yeah, could. But I think right now when you're addressing the moment in time, I think we haven't rationed at a pace to slow down consumption to get to that point, in my opinion.
Dan, Brian mentioned a couple technical points. Have you been watching those markets or those charts, and can you give us an idea where you see things technically at this time?
Well, there's no doubt about it. The weakness that we saw this week, it actually started last week a little bit, has really ripped up the charts, at least from a bullish angle, or has dressed them up from the bearish angle. Anytime you see a collapse like this and a liquidation that we've seen in the marketplace, you know, that is that tells you that you're in a bearish situation. And I think, you know, unless we do get some weather problems in here, the corn market really looks teed up to collapse probably easily another 50 cents without a lot of work. And then the beans, that one's kind of a confused type picture in a sense, is that the market went sharply higher Thursday on the new crop supply demand balance sheet, which should have been pretty well expected. I mean, anytime you saw the decrease in soybean acres or the March number, you multiply that by a trend line yield, you're going to have a small crop, especially with the type of demand that we have seen come into the marketplace with a big fall off in South American supplies. So at least short term here, we're going to have to probably do some more liquidation clear across the board, and then we'll kind of see where we're at after we do that. But I think another big factor in this market, and you can really correlate it pretty well, is when the dollar strengthens, the market just basically goes lower, and when the dollar weakens, it goes higher. So the uncertainty of what's happening in the Eurozone and fear that Greece is going to walk away from the Eurozone next week is really bullish the dollar as everybody basically runs for safety. So we do have one of these run-for-safety deflationary-type moves underway right now.
Yeah, you know, when you talk about the dollar, Dan, we saw the dollar today, the highest that it's been in the last year. And I think when you look at the market, USDA certainly had impact on this market, but boy, we've thrown more things at the market than, you know, the baby and the water and the soup and everything has all gone at the market this last week with the extended hours that we're talking about, actually boycotting the ICE futures that are going to start on Monday. It's just amazing. But Greece, you hit right on it. Greece is really the key to everything. They've tried three times now to form a government since their election. They haven't been able to do it. And if they default, that certainly leads to the possibility of Spain, Portugal, Italy, and Ireland following right in path with it. So I don't doubt that that's probably one of the key things that's driving traders right now. It's just plain fear.
May soybeans this week had a high of $14.72¾, the low at $14.02¾. Settlement price there was 71 cents lower at $14.04. November beans at $13.21¼, down 45½¢. I bet it was a solemn mood with producers in the field planting beans on Friday morning and finding a 50-cent loss in the marketplace by the time they get to Friday afternoon.
Well, I think the biggest thing, obviously, we talked on this earlier, is fund liquidation. You can derive a lot of factors to that, length, profit-taking, stepping to the sidelines. Fundamentally, I don't think a lot has changed. We have a huge loss in South America. Logistically, this fall, the U.S. is going to be required and needed to supply anywhere from 75% to 80% potentially of their crop in a six-month window before South America raises their 2013 crop. So fundamentally, I don't think anything's changed for beans to the upside, but Dease corn is the leader, I think, in the market complex and will act as an albatross pulling things lower if we continue to see good conditions.
And that brings me to the corn-soybean ratio. Will it stay as it is at this point with soybeans being drugged down with the corn?
Well, I think Brian and I were talking about before the show, the key question is we have corn wanting to go higher or go down, and we've got beans wanting to go higher. And so who wins? Corn has always been the king of the market, and I do believe that that ratio probably is going to change. And I don't see it improving or changing a lot from where it is right now, but I think that most people have made their decisions on planting anyway.
Hey, Dan, you have mentioned possibly a 3-to-1 ratio, so that would put corn, what, at $5.05¼ in the December tonight, but soybeans at $13.21¼. You think your ratio projections are still in play of maybe a 3-to-1 or not?
Well, I think so. I think that's the overall trend to go to 3-to-1. And you can do that pretty easy. You know, if you put $4 corn and 3 times 4, then it's basically $12. Or if you want to go to maybe 450, you can maybe get 1350 beans. But this bean market is going to, this new crop bean market is all altogether a different story. Unless we find some more acres on the June report. There's a tremendous fall off in South American inventory. There's going to be a lot of sales on the books. So beans are still going to be your leader. Corn is going to be the dog of the bunch based upon basically the large plantings and expectations that we may even see a little larger planting in the June report. And then there's basically we're off to a real good start. So that's where the market wants to focus right now. I mean, the story in the commodity complex is basically the bearish story. That's where the trade is focused. Now, in 2 weeks, if we would happen to start turning hot and dry, then it begins to take some of that put premium back into the marketplace. But right at the moment, everybody's kind of focused on overall good crop conditions and looking toward a very big crop come this fall.
So, Jackie, we have Brian saying corn is the leader. Dan says beans are the leader, although he's putting a 4 in front of corn and and then multiplying by 3. What do you say?
What do I say? I still say I think corn is the sleeper in some respects. We're also focused right now on these big numbers that came out of the USDA. The thing that we're putting to the side is we did see 300,000 metric tons of corn sold to unknown. And if China does decide that it really wants to step up and buy now at these prices, that could change this market in a very short amount of time. So I'm not going to count corn out just yet.
And could each of you give us your view of both the corn and the soybeans for new crop sales and whether it's changed this week and what your best advice for producers at this moment in time might be? And we'll start with you, Jackie.
Well, you always have to look at every individual and how much they've actually sold already. I think that we've had lots of opportunities to be able to put protection in place with puts. I would have to say that I'd want to get into the beginning of next week before I'd make any major decisions at all.
We've encouraged people to look at catch-up sales in these levels on any bounce to these corn to 515, 520. I think the producer on corn should be at least 40 to 50% sold. If we continue to sell off, I don't want to get overly aggressive under 480. That's the kind of the insurance put at an 85% policy. So I think those are good percentages to be at for corn. Beans, I think about the same, and especially if guys are switching acres, they should look at locking in a profit.
And Dan?
Well, back when I was in the advisory service business, I kind of wanted to do 25% of my crop before planting, 25% of the crop once I get it in the ground. So I guess I'm kind of in this 25 to 50% area. I don't think I would want to panic and sell into this weakness. It's pretty early in the growing season to panic yet. But I would be looking at rallies, and I would take a good look at minimum maximum strategies offered at the local elevators with options embedded in a cash contract.
All right, Dan. Hey, one other thing, Dan, before we move our way to Jerry Bangy in a couple of minutes, I wanted to discuss something that you and I had a conversation about on your very last day here in with Commodity Week with Cooley a couple of weeks ago. Once we heard that you were going to CGB Enterprises and that you were at their brand new export facility, and I think it's the newest one in the Gulf port, I thought it would be a good idea to come down and see you. Actually, well, to see come down and see that export facility. And we decided to put a bus tour together. You've been helping me do that with CGB Enterprises, and you've got some things planned down there. We're going to stop if we put this tour together, right, and see you and see that new export facility. Is it a really cool place?
Yes, it's got some age to it, but it's the newest one down here in the Gulf. It's really the flagship of export loading facilities. It's Zeno Grain Corporation, which is a shareholder in CGB. And, we've got a good program kind of lined up for the bus tour. Maybe stop at our Mound City location, which is a big river rail terminal deep down in southern Illinois that moves a lot of inventory through that. That's on the Ohio River. And then come on down to New Orleans and see the Zeno Grain Corporation's big export facility, and then maybe spend an evening or so down in the French Quarter.
Absolutely. Two evenings in the French Quarter, one in Tunica at the casinos. More on our website at willag.org.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers.
This is the May 11 edition of Commodity Week from the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Our guest on the phone line this week comes to us from the World Agricultural Outlook Board in Washington, D.C. Jerry Bangy is instrumental in putting together the WASD, or World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates. Jerry, thank you so much for taking the time and staying late on a Friday evening in Washington to be with us. Can you tell us how it is that the 166 national average yield was calculated in the latest WASD figures?
Yeah, I'd be glad to, Todd. I know there's been a lot of discussion about that. I know it was mentioned in the previous part of the program, what is termed, I guess, a big number. I think you have to understand, first off, it's not a simple trend that is used to calculate that number. The 166 is calculated with a fairly sophisticated model that really keys off of the crop development and crop progress in Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Missouri, and Ohio, Those, as you know, those states account for about half of U.S. corn production. So when you have, basically what happens is you have early, if you have early planting progress in those states and you assume normal weather here out, and you take that, take the model, which is the model includes a, there's a trend component in there, there's a planting progress component in there, and there is an average July temperature, and an average July precipitation, measure in there. And when you take all those factors and put in that model, and you do, in fact, use 2011, I might add, for that, when calculating the actual, yield prospects for the year, you do in fact wind up with 166.
I wanted to ask you. I know that Brian's probably going to ask you about the feed number, so I just wanted to ask you about the Brazilian corn crop number. And when I saw that 5 million metric ton increase, why is it that it? Boy, we can jump up 5 million metric tons. We can never go down that quickly.
Well, let me tell you what the situation is there. Number one, Brazil's been coming on strong in virtually every commodity, as you know. It's not only soybeans, but they're coming on in cotton, and they're coming on and now in corn. What has happened down there, the Brazilians have discovered that they can produce a crop of corn following a soybean crop up in that Mato Grosso area. And they're expanding. That's the so-called the Cerrado or the Savanna area. There's been a lot of expansion up in there. And what they've done, they at the time they're making these decisions, of course, corn looked like an attractive thing to them, and they in fact, have increased that area very sharply. It used to be just maybe 8 or 10 years ago that something like 25% of the Brazilian corn crop came from the so-called second crop. They produce two crops down there. The second crop now is accounting for nearly half, and that's what we're seeing following in the same year, following soybeans up in that Mato Grosso area. They can put a significant quantity of corn in, and that's what they did this year. We suspected early in the year they were going to do that, but we didn't have verification of that until fairly recently. It's sort of analogous in a way to what happens in the U.S. If you get the spring wheat crop off or the winter wheat crop off fast enough, you can, in fact, have a bump up in the soybean area numbers.
Jerry, I obviously alluded to this earlier, but I wanted you to expand on the stocks number. Always is a big discussor off of each quarterly stocks report, seems like the last 6 to 8. But given the March 1st stocks number being about 150 million bushels light and most in the trade looking for an adjustment upward in April, the government left things unchanged and then actually decreased feed usage here on Thursday. Any reason why that was the case?
Well, I guess I would start out by saying, remember what happened to us last year, where at the end of the year, what was roughly about 200 million bushels showed up at the end of the year in the NAS stocks report that we had not anticipated here. One of the things we do see happening this year is what I think you mentioned earlier on the program, and that is we do expect to see, given the fact that the corn supplies are tight, and they're going to get tighter, and they're going to get tighter for the next several months, we're going to see that. Until that new crop comes on. Now, we will see more wheat feeding as a result of that, and there are wheat supplies available. Second, I alluded to the fact that we have this yield model, and one of the things in this yield model, as I said, looks at crop progress. And if you look at what has happened, actually, as of May 6, I think nearly 80%, 78%, I believe it was, of the corn crop was planted in those five states that I mentioned. We anticipate this year that there's going to be a lot of new crop corn available prior to the end of the old crop year, if you know what I'm saying, which will in fact get into the supply chain. And as a result of that, when NAST goes to count the old crop stocks, we would anticipate to see somewhat more stocks there than some people anticipate.
So you're suggesting that the numbers actually do include new crop corn in the old crop stocks?
No, not at all. No.
Okay.
That'll show up. Anything like that would show up next year and show up in the first quarter of next year. It does get to be kind of confusing when NAS counts the stocks. They in fact they do differentiate between. They do ask for old crop stocks. That's what they're looking for.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to clarify.
Yeah.
I was quite certain of that. How far ahead do you think the current crop in those five states might be?
I tell you, the analysis we've done here, there could be as much as, this is kind of a shocker, but there could be as much as a billion bushels, show up in there. So it's a big number. That could, in fact, show up in the old crop year.
Dan, you have a question for Jerry?
Well, I'm still a little bit confused. If you trace out a balance sheet based upon current year supply, and then you're basically saying that next year's supply is going to work backwards, therefore we're not going to feed as much old crop corn, instead we're going to feed new crop corn. Is that what you're telling me?
Now, what we're saying is that in this year's, what's going to happen is some of the old crop corn will remain there as new crop corn. What seems to happen is new crop corn comes right in from the field, goes to the elevator, and goes right into use. May not pass into the stocks or elevator situation where it stays. In other words, it's utilized. The new crop corn can be and will be, some of it will be, not obviously not just a portion of it will be used before the old crop corn is utilized.
Well, I understand that at the local elevator level, when you got corn coming in early, you don't know if it's new crop or old crop, or corn going out, whether it's old crop or new crop. But so then this September 1 stocks report that comes out, are you going to adjust that then? Is that going to be adjusted back to reflect the old crop inventories, or is that going to have some new crop inventories in?
No, when NAS reports the inventory on September 1, what they will do, or the September inventory as of September 1, they will be looking at they will be asking for what the old crop corn, that's what they'll be counting at that point. They'll count what is there, and they do differentiate between the old crop and the new crop.
Yeah, but then you're double counting, or
No. It's no double counting anywhere.
How do you separate it out? Then you're going to say then next feeding year, if you're going to feed this 12 crop in this 11-12 year, then you're going to say then the 11 or the 12-13 is going to have less feeding in it. Then.
No, the new crop will be gone. Some of the old crop will still be there, but the new crop will be part of the production number for the 12-13 year. So the new crop will be counted as production, but it will have been utilized already. There will still remain some old crop corn because of that.
Can I ask? All right, Jerry, let's back up and let's talk about that September report again. We know what a disaster it's been a number of times. Are we possibly looking at a situation again coming up in December where you might actually show old crop stocks remaining because new crop took the place of it?
Yeah, that's
what you're saying, right?
Essentially what I'm saying, that's how it would show up in the numbers. Yes, that's what I'm saying.
And that's why the 50 million bushels shows up instead of 801 this time, right?
Yes, mm-hmm, right.
The other question I was going to ask you, Jerry, I guess from a standpoint, it seems like maybe China's estimated usage for next year at 7 million metric ton for import seems a little light, given some of their new crop purchases pace up to date. How do you feel about that going forward?
We have been, for a number of years now, there's been a lot of discussion out there. I know this past year, or actually the 11-12 year, the year that we're in now, there was a lot of discussion about, we saw estimates as high as 15 million tons and so forth, which we just didn't, we felt strongly was not going to happen. Now they have been, as you know, and as was alluded to earlier in the program, they have been fairly active recently. There is a stipulation in the WTO agreement that they should, in fact, purchase about 7 million tons. That's the number we've got in there now. And for the current year, I think we're at 5 now, based upon their current behavior. But I will tell you that one of the things we always watch with China is China can think of numerous ways to maybe not take the 7 million tons. I'm not saying they won't, but they have ways of getting around that. But they are, in fact, expected to take 7 million tons.
Okay.
Now, at this point, if you're asking, do we think they're going to take more? No, we do not think they're going to take more at this point.
Okay, we have passed our time, but that's okay, because I'm still recording and we can use it on the net. Does anybody else have a – Dan, do you have a follow-up to your line of thought?
No, other than, you know, there's a lot of water going under the bridge before we raise this big crop. Granted, if you take a snapshot right now, things look pretty good. But I've seen ideal conditions turn sour toward the end of the season many times. So,
could I respond to that? I'd like very much to respond to that because what the gentleman just said, truer words never spoken. What we're looking now is you got to remember that when USDA does a forecast like this, we're assuming normal weather. Let me just point out a couple of things here. I know everybody's talking about the 166 as being a very, very strong number. The yield in 2009 was 164.7 bushels per acre. That's by actual count. That year, we had very slow planting progress. We were only 33% planted by the time we got to May the 6th, in terms of those five states I was talking about. It turned out, however, that July temperatures, and this is the key. I think this July temperature really has to be considered. The July temperature in the heart of the Corn Belt there was 69.3 degrees. That was below, well below, that was the average temperature, well below the 74.3 degree average. As a result of that, even with the slow planting progress, we wound up with a crop of 164.7. This year, we're talking about we've got 78% of the crop planted. That means well in advance of that magic mid-May number that we talked about for years, May 15th. And we're looking at average temperatures that we're assuming average temperatures of 74.3. That's part of this model that we're using here. Now, if there's a deviation from that on the unfavorable side, then obviously you would wind up with a yield less than that. If you're on the favorable side, you might wind up with a yield even bigger. So what we're looking for now is the normal weather scenario, given the fact we've had early planting. But as you can see, depending on what the weather does in July, and I can't emphasize that enough, I mean, our experience in the recent 4 or 5 years has been, number one, crops are being planted earlier, and certainly along with number one is that July temperature is absolutely critical.
But can you back up just so in the calculation, you used a July figure that is equivalent to July of when?
No, and what I'm saying, in 2009, with the year that we had the record yield of 164.7, the actual temperature was not an estimate, was 69.3.
Right.
The 2012 forecast that we've been talking about, the 166 bushels, assumes a normal or an average temperature of 74.3, which is normal, based on the 30-year averages for the Corn Belt.
Oh, and you're suggesting that a normal would be better than a cooler one? Because
I'm suggesting that
will be in June and it'll be cooler anyway.
No, I'm suggesting that in July, if the temperature deviates from what we would consider to be normal weather, 74.3, at a normal temperature of the average temperature of 74.3 for those states I mentioned, we would expect to see a yield of 166 bushels an acre. If there is a deviation from that, either one way or the other, then it's going to the yield probably will be different, and primarily because that it turns out that July temperature is absolutely critical.
Yeah, but wouldn't you'll have to forgive me, but wouldn't a crop that's 80% planted at this point not be dependent on the July weather but the June weather?
No, it's not. I don't think it's going to. One of the things we have had record emergence. But when you've had we've had lots of reports this year on the cool nights of the temperature, the crop not developing very fast. Things are not quite like that. There may be some. I'm not discounting what you say entirely. It could move forward to some degree, but I don't think it's going to move forward that much.
And then, just on the calculation for mm-hmm. the 166, mm-hmm. did it or did it not include 2011 yields?
Okay. Now the confusion I think there, Todd, has to do with if you assume a simple trend, what we do, and if we're calculating a simple trend, this year we did not use 2011. The reason for that is that if you incorporate, particularly at the end of a statistical series, if you take a number A yield in the yield in 2011 was, as I recall, 147.2 bushels an acre. That was about 14.5 bushels below trend. You take that kind of a number and you incorporate that into a simple trend which has no other variable in it other than trend. What you will do is deviate sharply from the prevailing trend, which we know to be somewhere in a 2 or 2.3 bushels an acre.
It drops to 2.5 bushels.
Mm-hmm.
It drops at about 2.5 bushels,
right? It drops it whatever it turns out to be. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what the number was. It was actually 14.5 bushels per acre below trend at that time because of the very hot temperatures. We had temperatures in July of 2011 that were two standard deviations above normal. The average temperature in the Corn Belt was more than two standard deviations above normal. We would not, and it's always been, I might add, it's always been USDA's practice not to incorporate, particularly at the end of a series, you wouldn't want to take a number which is sort of an anomaly given the fact of the weather conditions there and put that into the trend line, because what that in effect would do, and maybe that's what you're referring to, Todd, if you put 2011 in there, you're right. It would drop the trend by about 2.4 bushels an acre.
That's right.
You're exactly right.
But if you're going to do that, why don't you throw 1988 out or 1993 out?
Well, number one, our session, we would. I'll tell you, I think most analysts back in the days when we're using 1990 forward. Okay, now if you went back to, I'm sure.
I'm sorry, I'm thinking I gave you 88, but it's not included to begin with. But 93 is.
No. Well, if you take 93, but it turns out that statistically, and this is where it gets into arithmetic here. But if you're somewhere in the middle of the series and you have these aberrations on both sides of the trend, doesn't have nearly the impact that if you have this anomaly that occurs at the end or the beginning of a trend. A lot of people have suggested over time that we use some kind of a rolling trend yield, where you would just keep moving forward, just take the most recent 10 years and the most recent 20 years and keep moving forward. If you do that, and it turns out that the beginning year is a low year and the end year is a high year, it will actually tilt your trend line to something that's just not reasonable. Vice versa happens if it happens to hit that the first year was a low year, a high year, and the last year was a low year, then it goes the other way. So you got to be very careful about that. And USDA has always removed, in a situation like this, would never use a year, as particularly as the end year, which is a sharp deviation from a normal condition. Remember now that our 2012-13 forecast reflects what we would consider to be normal weather, which is the average temperatures that we expect to see in July.
Jerry, one of the things that that concerns me, we keep talking about the 164.7. You know, we had a cooler July, but we also had the most extended heat into the fall that we've ever had. It finished the corn crop up north. It finished the corn crop down here. And nowhere does that fit into a model.
You're right. I mean, you can't put everything in there. But remember now, this is we're in May. We're talking May here. In the National Ag Statistics Service will not put its first estimate out until August. Mm-hmm. So we have to, there's only so many things you can assume about the out year and about what's going to happen over the rest of the season. Right now, we're getting on the model that I just described to you, our R square on that model is about 92% when we use that. In other words, if you use that model to forecast the years, you'd have about a 90% R-square value.
Reliability, okay. Now, the other question I wanted to ask you is this. At any time now at the USDA level, have you considered putting more than just those five states into your model?
There's no reason why we couldn't, and certainly we may want to do that. I think we picked these five because as I said earlier, they account for about half of U.S. production. They're the big states, but I don't really see any reason why that could not be done. I'm not a modeler myself. I mean, I could actually talk to the modelers about that and see what their feeling is on that and why they haven't done it. If they haven't done it, chances are, I'd venture a guess that they've already given it a try, And for some reason, they've decided not to do that. But I will certainly ask them that.
Well, I would like that because it really concerns me when I see how many acres of corn we increased in the Dakotas.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
And, mm-hmm. and where Minnesota stands.
Yes.
You know, so.
Yes. Well, you're right. I mean, periodically, these things have to be reviewed to see if they're still reflecting what we think they're reflecting. And if there's other states that have come on that should be included in this model, we certainly would put them there. There's no reason. There's no reason mechanically why we wouldn't.
Jerry, what does the World Board consider pipeline inventories for corn and soybeans?
You're talking about when pipeline inventory on a balance sheet in terms of a stocks use ratio type of a thing? Or what
no,
we would consider
I mean,
to be?
How many bushels of grain can you is included in the pipeline? What do you think is the pipeline inventory
you're talking about
on a balance sheet?
You're talking about what is missed during the stocks calculation?
No. What do you think, if we had a real tight situation, what is the bottom number we could get to?
I don't know. I'll tell you that, and I can honestly say I don't know, but I'll tell you there are people that have claimed in the past, we saw it written a lot last year, that we would never go below some sort of, I think I used to see people writing something about a 5% stocks-to-use ratio, that we wouldn't let the numbers fall that low. Well, number one, there's nobody's ever imposed that restriction upon us. Number two, we haven't seen it going that low as yet. Now, over in the soybean world, we are looking at a very tight, much tighter situation at the end of 2013, and we're looking at the end of 2012-13, we're looking at now. But for corn, we're looking at I'm not sure what the current stocks use ratio is. I think it's around, well, for the current year, it's falling to about 6.7%,
right.
And for the out year, it's 13.7%.
I guess I don't think stocks use ratio means anything when it comes to trying to figure out pipeline. I mean,
well,
pipeline
I know what
daily
the bottom ending stocks
is.
Would, what the smallest ending stocks might be.
Yeah, well, I guess that's what I'm talking about. But I will also tell you that one of the things that has changed in our world recently, and I say recently in terms of like the last five to seven years, has been the advent of ethanol, where you've got plants going corn production going straight from farms right into the ethanol plants, and apparently the ethanol plants do very little storage, so it moves right on through. So all these questions are somewhat compounded, but at the same time, we do know that the storage capacity on farms has been growing fairly significantly in recent years. But the truthful answer is to you, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know what the maybe I should ask you. What do you think the pipeline is?
Well, I just look at monthly consumption, and I find it just like last year when the World Board was projecting 650 or 675 ending stocks. I mean, I don't think you can get that low when you've got monthly usage last year was running at about 1.1 billion bushels, and that's basically what you ended up with at the end of the day.
Well, let me just say to you, I might actually have to agree with you on that because I know that our grains analyst here was feeling the same way. And then, as I indicated earlier, we had the 200 million bushels roughly show up at the end of the year, which suggested that you're right, that it was there, right?
I'm suggesting that the market, the signal that you were telling, the World Board with the lower carryout, sent the signal to the market that it had to ration some inventory. So we rationed inventories to the point so we ended up with an ending stock basically equal to a monthly usage. Now I think... I think you guys are going the other way now and overcompensating and sending the market the signal that it doesn't have to ration, that it's all got all kinds of old crop inventory around. And I think... You better hope for an early harvest,
well,
or otherwise you're going to come in here in that June 1 stock report, and you're going to see some really tight inventory. And the market's reacting to the downside based upon the World Board projecting a comfortable supply of corn.
I don't think that if you ask the analysts here, the people working on this every day here, I don't think they would say that we have a comfortable supply out there. We do think the situation is going to get tight as we move toward the to the end of the year, and before that new crop, even the early new crop comes on, we think it's going to get tight. So I don't know that we consider it to be comfortable. Second, when you use the word compensate, that worries me a little bit, because we're not trying to compensate for anything really. What we're trying to do is tell it like we think it is, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but.
You said that, you know, last year you undershot it, so that those, therefore you're trying to compensate for last year's by thinking that the supplies are going to be a little larger.
No, I think the thinking is now. One of the things we learned, I think, last year is what we're talking about now. We do think this new crop coming on, and as I indicated, something else I said earlier here. We are in fact seeing more corn planted earlier, and if you look at some statistics on that, they're rather startling. If you look at the average planting dates we've seen in the last few years compared to what they were just 10 years ago, I think it would actually, you know, would kind of it would get your attention, because certainly something has changed there. There's no doubt about it, and that suggests that. There's something of a mismatch between the end of the year and the stocks numbers and so forth, which is very difficult for us to explain sometime, and that's I think that's where we are these days.
Jerry, one final question for you, a different topic. Have you come to any consensus that you'll be able to tell us about as it relates to the release of USDA reports once we do put 22-hour trading days into effect?
Well, let me give you a couple of thoughts on that, and I certainly cannot say anything definitive, but I can give you a little bit of a background on that. I happened to be here back in 1994 when we went to the 830 release, and the 830 release certainly changed our world here, because it meant that quite a number of us here got to work the night shift at USDA, which was not one of the most pleasant experiences, but that's what we had to do. The reason we went to the 830 release is that when we were releasing the data at 3 o'clock, CBOT, of course, was a big player at that point. I don't think that ICE was quite a major competitor as they are now. But CBOT was very concerned, and rightfully so, that the Asians, particularly the Japanese markets, were trading on USDA numbers before we were. Now we have a situation where we've gone from to this 22-hour trading, and it seems to us we may be on the way to 24-hour trading. So the question is then, what becomes the optimal time to release? And I will tell you, I don't know what the answer to that is. We have gotten, I can tell you also that the commentary we've gotten from the public, there's been people talking about 10:30, there's been people talking about 4:30, there's been people talking about 5 o'clock, 2 o'clock, and so forth. So the question is, how would one go about deciding what to do there? And That's a tough one. I can tell you that there has been and there will be a lot of thought given to it. Right now, it seems to us that the situation is somewhat in a state of flux with what I've been reading on the wire service today with regard to various protests, you might call them, being filed with CFTC, and I don't know what the outcome of all that's going to be. So it's sort of a story is sort of up in the air right now, but right now there has been nothing definitive done here at USDA, because we don't really know quite how to react quite yet until we know a little bit more about what the end game is going to be out here, and that's essentially where we are.
We have a large elevator manager in our studio, so maybe he's got an idea of when he thinks it might need to be released.
I guess our suggestion, Jerry, has always been whether it's 4 o'clock when the market in the 22-hour potential setup stops trading, or if it's, you know, 7:30 but the market, you know, somehow pauses. We've talked to the CME about this from our company standpoint, but I think obviously having time to digest the numbers is going to be a better long-term fit for any grain participant than in the middle of trading, where you're subject to volatile moves when the initial motion of the numbers come out.
Well, I certainly understand how you feel about that, and the issue here, though, is that in this area, I don't know that USDA has any regulatory authority with regard to when markets will open or close. I think that, and I may be speaking out of turn here, but I believe that will be a CFTC, Commodity Futures Trading Commission, will be the probably be the deciding agency there, I presume. I know that, I think I can say fairly safely that USDA doesn't have any authority in this area. Second, I understand exactly what you're saying, and, you know, if we had a magic wand here and could say maybe that that's what you would like and respond to what you like in an affirmative manner, certainly, and it certainly if that was preponderance of other people feeling the same way, I believe we'd probably do everything we could to make that happen. I just don't know whether or not, you know, I don't know what's going to happen at this point. And it does become a, we are concerned about it. We're very concerned about it, and we're going to do whatever we think serves the public best.
It seems that it would be awfully nice for you.
The CEM is not going to be satisfied till we go 24/7.
I think that's where we're heading. So. It seems to me, I'll tell you, even if they're not, you know, the other thing you need to consider is even the U.S. Government doesn't have control over all commodity markets, obviously. And for those in foreign places, which the, you know, I come from a day here when we used to issue the Wiser report. There would be reporters standing at the door, and we'd hand them to them at the door, and they would run for the telephones. that's ancient history now. And now we're in a day of this computers, 24-hour trading. These little electrons are flowing fairly rapidly. And
I guess one question that I have always puzzled me, why on your balance sheets, and even when the statistical service comes out with a Pacific yield, mm-hmm. why don't you publish ranges rather than a Pacific number? Now, I know automatically the trade is going to go right to the center, but let the trade have the choice of where they want to trade. If they want to trade the center, fine. If they want to trade the low side or the high side, I guess it just makes, I think it would be easier for USDA and you'd have less public relations problems if you would more publish ranges that exports are going to range between this and this. This is what we look at. This is what we think feed usage is going to be. And then as the year goes on, then you can maybe narrow those ranges in and, but you know, the trade just seems schizophrenic over maybe even a margin of error type number sometimes, just like, you know, the way the market performed this past week.
Well,
I guess that's my question.
Okay, if I can respond to that. In a way, you sort of answered your own question there a little bit, because if you go back in the history of the World Ag Supply Demand Estimates Report, I think what you'll find, there was a time when we did something very similar to what you are talking about, where there would be a favorable scenario and an unfavorable scenario.
Correct.
Now, in the case at hand, here we are. I'm sitting here looking at a corn crop of nearly 14.8 billion bushels. I don't know if you put in an optimistic scenario here, Lord only knows what the number would be, and then a pessimistic scenario. So you'd have a pretty wide range out there. When
well,
we
you
did
could,
that,
the production well, would be one thing, but same no. way with demand.
I know.
Got your production, even once you've got your production settled, as you go through month to month, leave a range at the beginning of the year, and then narrow that as time goes on, as you become more familiar with the actual supply.
Well, we do that. The only thing we're doing that now is on price. And I will tell you, there is a number of people that would prefer to say, let's just put a point estimate in for that, to be honest about it. What we were discovering is, and your point is well taken. I'm not being argumentative at all. I understand what you're saying. It does make for a more complex balance sheet when you're looking at the numbers here. And what we found that people were doing when we did what you're describing was basically taking the midpoints. And,
well, let them.
You know,
but if another trade group wants to argue the lower side, they'll argue the lower side, but not be the, you know, kind of whistle. This is exactly what we're going to export. This is exactly what we're going to feed.
Yeah, well, you know, I would be delighted if it was exactly correct, but you and I both know that we're talking about something here where we've got Mother Nature to deal with. We got a long way to go before we get to the end of this crop year, and
that's why I'm giving you guys an out. Go with the range, and you'll be in it all the way through, and you won't be criticized.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but one of the reasons we do this on a monthly basis is because things change, and we try to reflect those changes on a month-to-month basis, but. You know, if there's a way to do that, we'll certainly look at that. And I'm not, brushing off your comment there. I can certainly go back and take another look at that and see if there's some way we could do that without somehow or other mystifying or confusing the market even a little bit more than it is now sometimes.
Jerry, I've got one more question for you. Mm-hmm. You made the remark that we'd probably be astounded when we see how much earlier corn is being planted every single year.
Mm-hmm.
In respect to that, would it justify taking the end of the crop year to July 31st versus August 31st?
Yeah, I think without telling tales out of school here, that thought has certainly crossed my mind. And let me tell you what the issues are with that. As soon as you go about doing that, then the issue becomes what is the history? And I'll tell you right now, it's going to be very difficult to figure. In other words, go back and adjust all of the so-called feed and residual disappearance numbers, the feed and residual cash category.
Mm-hmm.
Go back and create a series that brings us up to date where we are. If the world was clean and you could just stop from this day forward and start, then you didn't have to worry about history on the thing. But that becomes difficult to try to figure that out and have a meaningful set of numbers there. The second thing I would say is that's a little bit out of my purview here because those numbers are done by the National Ag Statistics Service. And if you recall, there wasn't too many years ago, and you might be able to recall, when they went from an October year to a September 1 year. I can tell you that took a very significant effort here to adjust all those back time series. So here we have a situation where we're starting with a difficult number to start with in terms of this feed and residual category, and then try to figure what that was in some prior time period to get us up to where we are now. But having said that, I do think that it would help people to understand the numbers better. I think your suggestion is really right on. The question is how to do it and can it be done, and whether or not the National Ag Statistics Service would go along with that. That's a question they would have to work on or answer. I can't answer that for them. But I think that's a very, very valid comment.
Jerry, thank you so much for taking so much time with us today. We do appreciate
sure.
it. Jerry Bange is with the World Agricultural Outlook Board. He's in Washington, D.C. Our panelists in studio today included Brian Stark of the Andersons and Jackie Vakes of Stuart Peterson. Both are from Champaign, Illinois. And Dan Zwicker was on the other phone line. He's with CGB Enterprises Incorporated in Mandeville, Louisiana. This has been the May 11 edition of Commodity Week. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.